Well, Merry Christmas to all of you. And I was just meeting with a group of men this past week, and we were kind of discussing, okay, if I was God, how would I come to planet Earth to really minister to human beings? And they said, well, we certainly wouldn't come as a baby. We would come in a giant dirigible with a flashing neon sign on it, I am God, and I'm here to set you all right. So, but that's not how he came, right? He came as a baby. So it's a wonderful time just to remember that God came in his humility and entered into our human estate so he could experience everything we experience and truly be the bridge between humanity and God, the Creator. And it was God, the Creator, that actually chose to come to us as a baby. Well, last week we talked about some fantastic scientific discoveries. I gave a little talk on the faint sun paradox. Thank you for allowing me to test that talk on you. It's the first time I've packaged it the way it was done and got some really good feedback from all of you. And yeah, I'm going to test another talk on you, but I don't have it ready yet. I want to get back into our lesson on Isaiah. And Colleen back there has all the handouts. And incidentally, they're also available at paradoxes.org. And yes, if you do have a question at class, we take a question anytime on any topic, but please wait for the microphone to come to you because this is live streamed. And we'll also take questions from people that are live streaming. If you're watching via live streaming right now, you're welcome to post a question and we'll be happy to deal with that. So, but right now we're in this little segment of our study of Isaiah and what it says about, predictive power. I mean, of all the books in the Bible, Isaiah is the one that's really loaded with predictions of future scientific discoveries, but also predictions of future historical events. Notice that when Jesus began his ministry, how frequently he quoted from the book of Isaiah, saying, this is the book that prophesied that I would come, prophesied that I would do. Well, often, as I told you in weeks past, I've run into skeptics and say, everybody talks about how the Bible makes these incredible predictions of future history, but it's all stuff that happened 2,000 years ago. This is really the Word of God. What is the same for me today? And actually, when I was not yet a believer, I had that same response. I was going through the Bible, and I said, yes, this seems to be an amazing book. It's predicting future science, future history. But it seems to be rooted in the history of 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago. But in my going through the Bible verse by verse, I kept coming across these passages that showed that the Bible had predictive power in events that are literally happening right before our eyes. And what particularly caught my attention is all the passages that speak about how God's going to raise up Israel as a Jewish nation for a second time. And it begins in the last sermon that Moses preached before he died, where he basically said, you Jews think you're going to be able to obey this law. You're not going to be able to do it. And what's going to happen is God will wind up having to judge you because of your failure to worship him. And he said, basically, you'll be cast out of the land to a nation to the east, and you'll be there as slaves. But he says, you'll be returned, but you'll rebel again. And this time, as we read 2 weeks ago, which you see in Deuteronomy 28 and 29, Moses said, the second time that you rebel against me, I'm going to scatter you to all the nations of the world. In fact, it was Moses who explicitly said, you'll be taken as slaves to Egypt, and you'll be sold in Egypt to all the nations of the world. In fact, you'll be sold in such great numbers, they'll be giving you away. You'll literally be given to people as slaves, sent to all the nations of the world. Moses went on to say, you're going to be scattered for many, many generations. But then he said, you'll be returned again. So after being scattered throughout all the world for many generations, he prophesied that you will be returned to your land again. God will bless you again. And if you've got this particular, by the way, if you don't have the handout, it's back there. I got a dozen of them here with me. So if you don't want to go to the back table, you can take a look at this in case you failed to bring it with you from last time. What I've done here in this handout is to give you all the passages in the Bible that are relevant to the second return of the Jews to rebuild the nation for a second time. And 2 weeks ago, we went through the first category, how the Bible, in many different passages, not just Isaiah and Deuteronomy, predicts that there will be a time when the Jews will be taken out of their land and sold as slaves to all the nations of the world. And once they're in those nations, they'll be chased from one place to another. Basically predicts the pogroms. I don't know if you know that much about the Jewish history, the diaspora, but the Jews would be settling in a particular community, usually a village or a city, and then the peoples in that nation would say, you're not welcome here, and they would begin to persecute them, and the Jews would have to leave that nation, go to another nation, and the same thing would happen to them again. Probably the most famous example of that would be the pogroms of the Jews that happened throughout the Russian Empire, where literally they were chased from one province of Russia to another. Nobody wanted to be there, and they just had to keep chasing. And if you ever saw that play, Fiddler on the Roof, it basically talks about that history of the Jewish period, where they're having to pick up all their belongings, go from one village, travel hundreds of miles, thousands of miles, settle again, have the same thing happen to them over again, where their possessions would be taken away from them. And this went on literally for 1,800 years. 70 AD is when Titus came in and basically took the Jews out of the land of Israel, took them to Egypt, and sold them as slaves throughout the whole of the Roman Empire and beyond the Roman Empire. That began what's called the diaspora. What I didn't share with you a couple of weeks ago, this is a well-known story where a bunch of British historians got together in the middle part of the 19th century. And basically they were talking about what are the major events of history. At one point in the conversation it was, well, what do you think are the most remarkable events that ever happened in the history of humanity? And one guy stood up and said, I think many would try to say it was the conquest of the Persian Empire by Alexander the Great. That's certainly a remarkable event in human history, and the fact that he couldn't hold on to his empire. But he said, really, the most remarkable event is the survival of the Jew. He says, who's ever heard of a people that was taken out of their nation and literally scattered to all the different nations of the world and had their culture and their nation and their identity as a Jewish people survive? He says, that has never happened to any other people group. They get assimilated. When the persecution comes, they marry people outside of their kith and basically get assimilated in society. That's happened with every other group that's been taken out of their land, with the exception of the Jews. They were the ones who were able to preserve their culture. And it says, actually, another remarkable fact, this is what happened in the 20th century. Historians look back and said, yes, it's a remarkable fact of human history that the Jews as a people and as a culture, as a religion, it all survived. But what is even more remarkable is that their language survived. He says, after all, consider that when the Jews were scattered to all the nations of the world, what language did they speak? They either spoke the language of the people and around in the nation in which they lived, or they spoke Yiddish. And yet today in Israel, what's the language? It's Hebrew. So here's this language that nobody spoke for 1,800 years. Matter of fact, if you actually look at the New Testament, it's clear that at the time of Jesus of Nazareth, even the Jews living in the land were not speaking Hebrew. The priests studied Hebrew, but the people were speaking Aramaic. And so it says it could be as much as 2,200 years, 2,300 years, where Hebrew was not spoken by the people. And yet today, it's the national language of Israel. How do you explain a language like that surviving? I don't know how many of you have ever studied a dead language. When I was being educated in Canada, they required us to learn Latin. Matter of fact, we actually had a teacher there who would teach us classical Greek if we wanted it. But I remember picking up my Latin book, opening up the first page, and a previous student had written a little poem in there, and it ran like this. Latin is a dead language, as dead can be. First it killed the Romans, now it's killing me. Yeah, this was actually a public school which I was taking this Latin in. I'm glad I took the course because it really helps you get a background for how to learn the European languages, because each one of them is kind of based on that. So, and it's a very mathematical language. Everything, the rules are never broken. So that was interesting comparing that to English. But Hebrew actually survived as a spoken language, even though no one was really using it in common speech for 2,200 years. Well, this morning, I'd like us to look at the second segment. I mean, we talked about the worldwide dispersion of the Jews, how it lasted for thousands of years, and yet the Jews as a people survived, their culture survived, their religion survived. This next section is looking at the second rebirth of Israel as a nation. And I think what was remarkable, and you actually see this in the New Testament epistles, is that Jesus fulfilled all the prophecies about him in the Old Testament in remarkable detail. And I think what impressed me before I became a Christian was reading Psalm 22. Psalm 22 is all about God dying on a cross. And what impressed me when I read that at age 19, it's like this was all written by King David 700 years before crucifixion was even invented as a method of execution. And yet that psalm describes in detail what happens when someone dies on the cross. And actually, if you read that psalm, in fact, if you've never really looked at it in detail, I'd encourage you to read Psalm 22 in the context of the crucifixion of Jesus, because not only does it describe in great detail how Jesus would die on the cross, including the spear being put into his side, and what would happen when that spear was put into his side, how none of his bones would be broken, but actually talks about how the clothing would be bartered for, gambled for by Gentiles. And indeed, that's what you see in the New Testament. The soldiers that crucified Jesus, the Roman soldiers, threw lots to see who would get his clothing. But that was predicted 1,000 years before the event happened. And I think what impressed me especially, comparing what you see in Psalm 22 to what you see in the New Testament text, is the words of mockery by the Gentiles and by the Jewish leaders are right there in Psalm 22. And if you actually look at what you see there in the Hebrew, translated in the Greek, it's one for one. The very words that were thrown at Jesus who's dying on the cross in mockery are the words that you see recorded in Psalm 22. And then what do you hear Jesus saying when he's put up on the cross? The words that are recorded in the gospel accounts, my God, why have you forsaken me? That's verse 1 of Psalm 22. What's the last thing that Jesus said on the cross? It is finished. Now, if you, again, translate what you see at the very end of Psalm 22 into Greek, it's the same thing. It is finished. And also, what you see in the gospel accounts, the centurion that was in charge of the crucifixion, he was watching Jesus dying on the cross, and when Jesus died, what did he say? Surely this was the Son of God. Which made me think, this is before I was a Christian, I'm wondering if this centurion was familiar with Psalm 22. And maybe it's even possible Jesus was quoting Psalm 22 as he was dying on the cross. After all, you got the first sentence and the last sentence. Wouldn't that have a dramatic effect on a centurion who was a follower of God, familiar with the Psalms, to actually see this being fulfilled right before his eyes? So this is why these verses on Israel, modern Israel, had an impact on me. It was a major part of my conversion, saying this is just like what we see of the Bible predicting what was going to happen to Jesus in his life. Here we are in the 20th century, the 21st century, and we're seeing the same thing happen again. And so as I go through these passages, and we're only going to look at the ones with the asterisk, If you got the time, I'd encourage you to look at all of them. But we're just going to look at the ones with the asterisks. But I think what you're going to see is just like you get a detailed prediction what was going to happen to the life of Jesus during his ministry here on earth, likewise, you get a detailed prediction of what's going to be happening in this modern nation of Israel. And you see that in each of these six subheads that we have here about these predictions in the Bible, these prophecies, about what would happen in Israel. So let me begin. And I'm old enough now I actually need these. I started having to wear these 9 months ago. So, all right. We begin in Deuteronomy 30. And Deuteronomy 30 starts this way. When all these blessings and curses I set before you come upon you, and you take them to heart wherever the Lord your God disperses you among the nations. So this is a reference that we talked about 2 weeks ago, how there will be a time when God would disperse them throughout all the nations. When you and your children return to the Lord your God and obey him with all your heart, with all your soul, according to everything I command to you today, then the Lord your God will restore your fortunes and will have compassion on you and gather you, and gather you again from all the nations where he scattered you. Even if you've been banished to the most distant land under the heaven, from there the Lord your God will gather you and bring you back. This is all in Deuteronomy 30, verses 1 to 9. He will bring you back to the land that belonged to your fathers. You'll take possession of it. So again, it's making reference. You'll be brought back to the land of your fathers. He will make you more prosperous and numerous than your fathers. And incidentally, that transition was passed just a year and a half ago. There are now more Jews living in the land of Israel than lived in Israel at its peak population level during the first two times the nation was there. That peak population level is 5 million. Today there's 7.5 million Jews living in the land of Israel. So this has now been fulfilled. The Lord your God will circumcise your hearts and the hearts of your descendants so you may love them with all your heart and with all your soul and life. The Lord your God will put all these curses on your enemies who hate and persecute you. You will again obey the Lord and follow all his commands I'm giving you today. Then the Lord your God will make you most prosperous in all the work of your hands and the fruit of your womb, the young of your livestock, and the crops of your land. The Lord will again delight in you and make you prosperous, just as he delighted in your fathers. If you obey the Lord your God and keep his commands and decrees that are written in this book of the law, and turn to the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. Now, I'm going to read the next couple of verses, because I think it's critical to this last sermon that runs from Deuteronomy 28 to Deuteronomy 32. He says, now what I'm commanding you today is not too difficult for you or beyond your reach. It's not up in the heaven so that you have to ask who will ascend into heaven and get it and proclaim it to us so we may be obey it. Nor is it beyond the sea so that you have to ask who will cross the sea to get it and proclaim it so we may obey it. No, the word is very near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart so you may obey it. Now again, I would commend to you reading all of Deuteronomy. This is the last message that God gave to the Jews before Moses died. And what you see as you go from 28 to 29 to 30 to 31 and 32, he's telling the Jews, you think you're going to be able to obey this law that God has given you. You will not be able to do it. And when you fail, God's going to judge you. He's not going to judge you once, he's going to judge you twice. But it'll come a time when you'll come to your senses and realize, you know what? I can't obey it. But God is the one who'll give me the capacity to obey it. And what you see as you move on into Deuteronomy 29 and 30, Moses talks about a prophet that will come after him. He says, one greater than me will come. And everything he says, you must obey. And he is the one that's going to give you the power to obey the law. You can't do it in your own strength. You have to depend on him. And basically what he's saying in the last words of his life, don't look to the law to save you. Look to the prophet after me that will come. He is the one. And you actually see this in the book of Job. who lived long before Moses. And he basically said, my only possible hope is in the Redeemer. I can't obey the law, but he's the one who is my advocate, who will be a bridge between what I can't do and God will step in and do it for me. He gets the same message with Moses, saying the law is not going to save you. The one that comes after me, he will give you the power to do what you can't do for yourself. We've got a question in the back. Wait for the microphone.
Well, that promise seems to be contingent on their turning away from their sin and turning to God with all their heart, but they haven't done that, and God's still restored the land, so.
Well, what you're seeing here in Deuteronomy 30 says you're going to be brought back to the land, the nation will reborn, and eventually you'll actually turn to me. That has not happened yet. Although what I find encouraging, the messianic movement in Israel is exploding today. I think 20 churches were launched just in this past year. So I think we're beginning to see the spiritual transformation of the Jews in the land of Israel. But yeah, most of the Jews in the land of Israel today are not followers of God. They're not Orthodox. I mean, there is an Orthodox Jewish community, but they're in the minority. Most Jews are secular Jews. But I think we're beginning to see a bit of a stirring take place. And if you look at Zechariah 11:12, it basically says a day will come when one-third of the Jews in the world will recognize the one they have pierced, they'll repent, and become followers of the Redeemer God. But that hasn't happened yet. And actually, as we go into the book of Ezekiel, particularly it talks about this next section, development in the modern nation of Israel, basically makes a prediction that God's going to restore the Jews to the land of Israel. They'll become a nation. They will be blessed by God with great material wealth and technology. They'll be victorious against all of their enemies. He does make the point that they're going to be fighting all the time with their neighboring nations. But he says, I'll fight for you like I did in the days of old, but you will not give me the credit. You'll think you did it by your own strength. But he says, I'm raising you up, and I'm working with you, fighting for you as I did in the days of old, not because of your sake, but because of the Gentiles. But you will not give me credit, but the Gentiles will. So it's basically making the point, even when the Jews get brought into the land of Israel, he's going to use their unbelief in the land and their ungratefulness towards God as a message to get out to the Gentile nations. And I think we're seeing that happen. Gentiles around the world are looking at what's happening in Israel and saying, this is no accident. You know, how can a few million people be victorious against 100 million plus? 100 million plus that are better financed than they are, and yet they were. And how can this nation be so incredibly blessed materially when all the nations around them are manifesting a level of technology and wealth far below? I mean, that's why when I kind of look at modern Israel, it's an undeniable miracle what's happening. But the Jews so far have failed to give God the credit. I got a collection of books in my office about all the wars that the Israelis have fought against their Arab neighbors. And when you read those books, the generals, the leaders, the prime minister, they never give God the credit. Interestingly, it was a Christian Egyptian general in the 73 war that gave God the credit. So the Gentiles did it, but not the Jews. Yeah, go ahead.
Isn't there a prophecy I learned in Mark's prophecy class? Maybe you can help me out, Mark. But the Jews will be scattered again, and half of them will be killed?
Well, this is a reference to what you see in the book of Revelation, how God's going to have this massive spiritual conversion amongst the Jews in Israel, mainly because they recognize the fulfillment that, hey, that they'll recognize that Jesus is the Messiah. And when that happens, there's going to be a massive revival in Israel. This is going to happen in the last 3.5 years before the return of Christ to planet Earth. And so what's going to happen in that revival, 144,000 Jewish Christians will be raised up as evangelists to the Gentiles. So think of it as 144,000 Jewish Billy Grahams traveling around the world, bringing hundreds of millions of Gentiles to faith in Christ. So yeah, that's in the book of Revelation, but again, that's not yet been fulfilled. But God obviously is preparing them right now. Okay, let me move on from Deuteronomy 30 to Psalm 102.
You?
Yes.
Over here.
Pardon me?
Over here.
Over here, okay.
Is there a word opposite to diaspora? Gathering in?
The gathering. Okay. Aliyah. Okay. Diaspora and aliyah. So okay. Yeah, that's the gathering together of the Jews back into the land. And we're going to be looking at a lot of these texts. Psalm 102, starting in verse 12. But you, O Lord, sit enthroned forever. Your renown endures through all generations. You will rise and have compassion in Zion, for it is time to show favor to her. The appointed time has come. This is referring to the second rebirth. For her stones are dear to your servants. Her very dust moves them to pity. The nations will fear the name of the Lord. All the kings of the earth will revere your glory, for the Lord will rebuild Zion and appear in his glory. He'll respond to the prayer of the destitute. He will not despise their plea. Let this be written for a future generation, that a people not yet created may praise the Lord. The Lord looked down from his sanctuary on high. From heaven he viewed the earth, to hear the groans of the prisoners and release those condemned to death. So the name of the Lord will be declared in Zion, and his praise in Jerusalem, when the peoples and the kingdoms assemble to worship the Lord. Now, one of the advantages I had before picking up a Bible in my teenage years was having a very thorough study in history. And having met my wife and a lot of Americans, I've learned that Canadian public education is much more intensive on history than is the case. Or in Canada is much more so the case. It was really alarming to me to come here to the U.S. and realize that I had a greater education on the Revolutionary War of the U.S. than Americans had, and the Civil War than Americans had, but also a lot of European and modern history as well. So when I came to this text, I was well aware of the history of the Holocaust and also what happened in the first year of the birth of the nation of Israel. Because when Israel was formed, there were only 500,000 Jews in the land. And yet all these Arab nations gathered together as a coalition to drive the Jews into the ocean, to drive them into the Mediterranean Sea, basically rid them of the land. And what struck me as I read this passage was recognizing that the key battle to establish Israel as a nation was fought by two regiments that were 100% made up of people released from Hitler's death camps. All of them had the number on their forearm here, indicating that they were going to be heading to the gas chambers. And so these two battalions took the greatest casualties in the War of Independence, but it was David Ben-Gurion that said back in 1948, if it wasn't for those released from Hitler's death camps that fought this battle to open up a corridor between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, there would be no nation of Israel. Their blood shed a great cost, made it possible for us to have a nation. Because he says, if we're cut off from Jerusalem, it's not going to happen. But here it says, those released from the death camps with a sentence of death upon them would be the ones that are responsible for making this nation happen. So I've read this to a lot of American audiences. It kind of just goes over their head. And I said, don't you realize what happened in 1948? I find a lot of them had no idea just how crucial that battle was. The Jews were literally losing the War of Independence. And one ship came in from Europe with all these people released from the death camps. And they immediately volunteered to fight the battle. So, and that to me is remarkable. Here you are being in Hitler's death camps. What's the first thing you do? you volunteer for the most dangerous campaign in the war. And but without that, there'd be no nation Israel. That's Psalm 102. And then moving on to Isaiah 11. Here we go. In that day, the Lord will reach out his hand a second time to reclaim the remnant that is left of his people from Assyria, from Lower Egypt, from Upper Egypt, from Cush, from Elam and Babylonia, from Hamath and from the islands of the sea. That phrase, islands of the sea, means the distant coastlands, referring to the large islands and continents that are beyond Eurasia. He'll raise a banner for the nations and gather the exiles of Israel. He'll assemble the scattered people of Judah from the four quarters of the earth. Ephraim's jealousy will vanish, and Judah's enemies will be cut off. Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah, nor Judah hostile towards Ephraim. They will swoop down on the slopes of Philistia to the west. Together they will plunder the people to the east. They will lay hands on Edom and Moab, and the Ammonites will be subject to them. Now, as you look at the first reference about the remnant that is left of Assyria, Lower Egypt, Upper Egypt, Cush, Elam, Babylonia, Hamath, the islands of the sea, these are the first Jews that came into the land of Israel before the 1948, the half million that arrived there. Because if you go to the very beginning of the 19th century, there was only a few thousand Jews in the land, but then they began to come, mainly because of the Balfour Declaration. In 1914, the British government got control of the land of Palestine and basically opened up the door for a small number to come. They did restrict immigration to Israel, but the ones that were coming were among the very countries that are mentioned here in Isaiah chapter 11. They were the first Jews to settle in the land, and they were the ones that were there at the rebirth of Israel for a second time. But the text makes the point that when the Jews come back for the second time, it's going to be different from what's happened previously. Because after all, when the Jews were brought back into the land after the Babylonian exile, what happened? There was a division between two categories of Jews. There were the people of Judah and there were the Samaritans, and they did not get along. In fact, they refused to even talk to one another. I mean, that's a remarkable thing about Jesus engaging this Samaritan woman. What a shock it was to her disciples. You're a Jew and you're talking to a Samaritan? That's a big no-no. And basically this text is saying, when the second rebirth happens, there will be no division amongst the Jews. And Israel today, they have these white-skinned Jews and dark-skinned Jews, the Sephardics and the Ashkenazis, and you'd think they would not get along, come from two completely different areas, one mainly from Africa, one mainly from Northern Europe, and yet they get along just fine. And so basically this thing was prophesying. When the Jews come back in the land, it's going to be different. After all, when Solomon's reign was over, what happened? The Jews split. You had Ephraim in the north and you had Judah in the south, and they didn't get along. They became two separate countries. And basically this text is saying, with a second rebirth, that's not going to happen. They will be united. In one sense, they were forced to be united because of the threats of the nations around them. But they are united. And then it says, verse 14, they'll swoop down on the slopes of Philistia to the west, and together they'll plunder the people of the east. They'll lay hands on Edom, Moab, and Ammonites will be subject to them. Again, if you look at the history of the formation of the nation of Israel, the first place they settled was the plains of Philistia. In fact, if you look at the 1948 border of Israel, it's basically encompassing that nation that was the nation of the Philistines. That's where they settled first. But this text goes on to say a time will come when they'll possess the land of Ammon, Moab, and Edom. That has not yet happened. Yes, they are in possession of the land of Philistia. They're not in possession of Moab, Ammon, and Edom. And if you go through all the passages I've given you here in the Bible, you'll see this comes up repeatedly, that a time will come after the nation is formed where the Jews and Israel will gain possession over Ammon, Moab, and Edom. And if you read all these passages, it makes this interesting point. They will not occupy Moab, Ammon, and Edom, but they'll have political control over Ammon, Moab, and Edom. So they'll gain control over this area, but they will not occupy it. Now, it was Winston Churchill who said that I created the nation of Transjordan with a stroke of a pen. But if you're familiar with the, well, in fact, the nation of Transjordan is identical to the nation of Jordan today. And if you actually look at the borders of the nation of Jordan as they are today, it perfectly encompasses the ancient territories of Ammon, Moab, and Edom. So this is basically a prophecy. A time will come in the future. We don't know how, but the Jews and Israel will gain control over Ammon, Moab, and Edom, but they will not occupy it. And the way I've understood that is there's now 7.5 million Jews living in the land. And again, as you read these texts, you're going to find some predictions in there that make the point that once the Jews begin to return, because there's actually saying a time will come when all the Jews in the world will be living in the land of Israel. That includes the 3 million that are currently in New York. It includes the 500,000 that are here in the Los Angeles area. Something that's going to happen that's going to motivate them all to emigrate to Israel. In fact, some of that is actually happening right now, where Jews here in America are moving to Israel. Why? Because they see an economic advantage to living this wealthy nation and going to a nation where there's more opportunity. To put that in context, right now, the nation of the world that's got the second highest number of NASDAQ listings is Israel. U.S. is first. We got the most number of NASDAQ listings. But number two is this tiny nation of Israel. They're number two on the NASDAQ listings. A lot of it is software companies. And a lot of people, in fact, I've actually met people who have left America and have moved to Israel because they think they have more opportunities in the software development ventures than they do here. And so that may be what will attract them. But it's also saying a time will come when the Jews in Israel say, this land is too small. We need more room. And you're probably well aware that there's a big controversy going on in Israel. Can we have Jewish settlements on the West Bank? And so there's people saying we shouldn't do it, people saying, but eventually a time will come and they'll say, we got to do something. There's simply not enough room in this little tiny space pre-1967 border. And so here's just a speculation on my part. Maybe a time will come when something happens to the king of Jordan, and this leads to a crisis, and the Jews step in and basically take care of it, and saying, okay, we're going to set up this nation of a Jordan. We're going to guarantee their security. That's going to be independent of us, but we're going to control its external affairs. And this is going to be the nation for all the Palestinians. And this side of the Jordan River will be ours. So basically solving the Palestinian crisis by using Jordan as a solution to the crisis. Pure speculation on my part, but I think it fits what we see here in these texts and other texts and explains why these texts repeatedly mention the territory of Ammon, Moab, and Edom. Something is going to happen where Israel will get control over that region but not use it for its own purposes, basically establish it as a homeland and a place for the Palestinian Arabs. Okay, moving on. Isaiah 14. Verse 1, the Lord will have compassion on Jacob, and once again he'll choose Israel and settle them in their own land. Aliens will join them and unite with the house of Jacob. Nations will take them and bring them to their own place. And this is what's remarkable. It's not only Jews that are returning to the land of Israel. Gentiles are coming to the land of Israel. Again, because of the economic opportunities they see there. Nations will take them and bring them to their own place. And the house of Israel will possess the nations as men servants and maid servants to the Lord's hand. And again, a lot of Arabs work in Israel. And they will make captives of their captors and rule over their oppressors. On that day, the Lord gives you relief from suffering and turmoil and cruel bondage. We can skip that part. And then move on to Isaiah 60, verse 9. Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord rises upon you. See, darkness covers the earth, and thick darkness is over the peoples. But the Lord rises upon you, and his glory appears to you. Nations will come to your light, and kings of the brightness of your dawn. Lift up your eyes and look about you. All assemble and come to you. Your sons come from afar, and your daughters are carried on the arm. Then you will look and be radiant. Your heart will throb and swell with joy. The wealth of the seas will be brought to you. The riches of the nations will come. And that down in verse 9, surely the islands look to me. And again, that reference islands is to the distant coastlands, a reference to distant continents and distant large islands. Surely the islands look to me, and the lead are the ships of Tarshish. Who's Tarshish? The northern Europeans and the descendants of the northern Europeans. I believe that's a reference to Australia and Canada and the United States. Surely the islands look to me, and the lead are the ships of Tarshish, bringing your sons from afar with their silver and gold to the honor of the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, for he's endowed you with splendor. And I think I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, how one of the key events in the birth of Israel back in 1948 was this coalition of 10 Arab nations that were gathered around to wipe out Israel. And Israel, all they had was primitive arms, basically shotguns and rifles. And they were facing nations who had tanks and fighter aircraft and well-trained armies. And it was David Ben-Gurion that said, we need money to buy modern arms. And he also found out that in Czechoslovakia, there were several companies there. This was before the communists took over at Czechoslovakia. He said, they're willing to sell us arms, but we got to come up with the money. And that's when he sent Golda Meir to New York with $10 in her purse. And she came back with $50 million. Basically, the Jews in New York sent her on a tour all over the U.S. and Canada. She came back with $50 million. Those $50 million were used to buy arms from the Czechoslovakian arms companies. Basically, it was obsolete arms from World War II, but the Jews used those obsolete arms with great effectiveness against their Arab attackers and were able to win the War of Independence. And it was David Ben-Gurion, after the War of Independence was over, who said, it's all due to one woman who had $10 in her purse that the nation of Israel is here today. And of course, Golda Meir later became the prime minister of Israel. But what's interesting, in her prime ministership, she never talked about that trip. She was very modest about the achievement she had gotten back in 1948. Okay, Isaiah 66, verse 7. Before she gets into labor, she gives birth. Before the pains come upon her, she delivers a son. Who has ever heard of such a thing? Who has ever seen such things? Can a country be born in a day, or a nation brought forth in a moment? Yet no sooner is Zion in labor than she gives birth to her children. Do I bring to the moment of birth and not give delivery, says the Lord? Do I close up the womb when I bring to delivery, says your God? Rejoice with Jerusalem and be glad for her. All you who love her, rejoice greatly with her. All you who mourn over her, for you will be nursed and satisfied at her comforting breast. You will drink deeply in delight in her overflowing abundance. So a couple of things is making a reference here is that the second rebirth of Israel nation will be a sudden event, totally unexpected, and something that's going to really get the attention of the Gentiles. And again, if you've never done this, I'd encourage you, go back and look at the history of 48, especially look at the newspaper headlines that were being published in 47 and early 48, because that 47 is when the Gentile nations first became aware of the extent of the Holocaust. This is when they were digging up these huge graves. I remember looking at one of them as I went through the microfiche of old newspapers, where they estimated there was 100,000 Jewish skeletons in a single grave. And these were all over Eastern Europe. And when people saw that, they said, Zionism is finished. Zionism is a term of the reference of the desire of the Jews to get their nation reborn. And the Zionist movement was focused in the nation of Poland. Poland had 4.5 million Jews slaughtered in the Holocaust. And once people realized the extent of the Holocaust in Poland, they said, that's the end of the Zionist movement. There's going to be no nation Israel. And this is when the British stopped immigration in the land of Israel, basically prevented ships from going to Israel with the Jews that were had just been released from the death camps. They said, this is it. 500,000 Jews, no way can they establish a nation. Zionism is done. And yet, within days, you see the announcement of Israel, a nation. And I mentioned a couple of weeks ago also that in here in the book of Isaiah, it says the name of the new nation will be Israel. What was interesting, all the way back to 1900, the Zionists said, when we finally get the nation born, we're going to call it Zion. And it was David Ben-Gurion at the last minute in May of 1948 and said, there's going to be no vote here in the Knesset. We're calling the nation Israel, and sat down. End of debate. And everybody kind of went along with it. And it was many years later when people pointed out to David Ben-Gurion, this was predicted in the Bible, yet he had no idea that it was in the Bible. He was not a believer, he was an atheist, and yet he was one who single-handedly fulfilled that particular prophecy. So it literally was born. And incidentally, what was ironic about the birth of Israel is that the nations of the world really didn't want to have this nation born. It was the Soviet Union that really pushed for the birth of Israel. The reason why, they saw all these kibbutzes, and they said, this is communism. Because the Jews that were settling in the land of Israel were forming these little collective farms. And so we have Joe Stalin looking at that and saying, we have an opportunity to have a communist nation right there in the Middle East. And so he was the one that was really pushing, let's make Nation of Israel happen. The other remarkable thing was, when the nation was formed, Truman was the first one to recognize the nation. Because he said, you know what? We have to stop what the Russians are planning to do. And Truman understood that these Jewish collective farms were not built on communist principles. Yes, it was people kind of sharing their knowledge and their wealth for a collective purpose, but it was all based on people being free to come and go. If you want to be part of this, you can. And if you want to go to another kibbutz, you can. And so very different principle, which you see in communism, and very entrepreneurial. They saw this as a way to actually more efficiently take advantage of the agricultural land. And Truman recognized that, so he jumped in and said, we're going to recognize. So you've got the Soviet Union and the United States being the first two to recognize this, and that kind of solidified it. And but again, war immediately broke out. Literally within hours after it was announced that this nation was formed, war broke out. Okay, Jeremiah 31. I'm not sure I'm going to read all of this. The entire chapter is devoted to the second rebirth of the land of Israel. And I encourage you to read that for yourself. But basically makes the point that when the nation is born, it's going to see an immediate revolution of wealth, particularly agricultural wealth. And to appreciate this, before the Jews began to return, the first Jews came back in the land in 1885. Before that, there were no Jews there. But they began to come back in 1885. By 1910 and 1920, they were establishing these small farms. But we see here in Jeremiah 31 is that they're going to transform a desolate land and make it fruitful. So when the Jews first came into the land of Palestine, what did they see? Barren ground. It was basically forests that had been cut down. It was a barren land. Nothing was growing there. If you really want to read an interesting account, Mark Twain visited the land of Palestine. And he wrote about his travels there. And he says, the most desolate land I've ever visited. Nothing's growing here. It's a parched land. It's providing nothing. He says, I read the Bible and it talks about how this is going to be a beautiful, gorgeous land. He says, forget it. This is not beautiful at all. Maybe it was one day, but it's certainly not now. It's the most barren and desolate place I've ever seen. Yet when the Jews began to come back, they began to transform the land. And basically, this is what Jeremiah 31 is focusing on. It's going to be fruitful. Matter of fact, just last night, we had a bunch of our relatives over to our place, and they were talking about their friends who have just been to the land of Israel a few weeks ago. But they were there as Californians, and they were there with a huge group of people from Europe. But he says, it was really exciting to all these people touring the land of Israel. So they had access to all this fresh fruit and vegetables right there at their hand. And he says, we were the Californians just saying, this is just like it is in California. But again, as I travel around America, we really got it good here in California. Within hours, we get our vegetables and fruit delivered to us from the Imperial Valley and the San Joaquin Valley. Everywhere else in the country, it takes a day or two to get there. It's just not the same. But what's interesting, hearing these comments about these people who just visited Israel, it's the same thing you go to Israel. The fruit and the vegetables are right there, are available, and are the highest quality of anything you see. And all these Europeans were saying, we see nothing like this in Europe. So that's right there. But this is what this text here in Jeremiah is talking about. But I want to share with you the last couple of verses of Jeremiah 31, because again, because I was a student of history, this had a major impact on me. And what it says in 31 is what's going to happen to the city of Jerusalem when the Jews begin to return and form the nation for a second time. It says, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when this city, the city of Jerusalem, will be rebuilt for me from the tower of Hananel to the corner gate. The measuring line will stretch from there straight to the hill of Gerab and then turn to Goa. The whole valley where dead bodies and ashes are thrown, and all the terraces out to the Kedron Valley on the east, as far as the corner of the Horse Gate, will be holy to the Lord. The city will never again be uprooted or demolished. And that last phrase is interesting because Jerusalem has been conquered and reconquered 27 times. But what you see in this passage and other texts, once the Jews gain control over the city of Jerusalem, it's not going to be conquered ever again. They will possess it from that time forward. But these first couple of passages here is basically making the point a day will come when Jerusalem will expand. Now, throughout the entire diaspora, Jerusalem was isolated to the old city walls. So for a couple of thousand years, that was the extent of the city of Jerusalem. What you see in what is now basically 1 square mile of the old city walls was the city of Jerusalem. But what you see here is the prediction that when the Jews begin to return, the city will be too small, and they'll begin to build suburbs outside the city. Now, what a remarkable impact on me is actually looking up all these geographical locations and then looking at the history of the building of the city of Jerusalem starting in 1885. The first suburb that was built outside the city walls, this was back in the late 1880s, in early 1990s, again, was just outside the Tower of Hananel, and the second to the corner gate. So it's really, in fact, I should bring you a map sometime. I've actually developed a map showing how the return of the Jews to the land of Israel, beginning in 1885, led to the development of 9 suburbs outside the city walls. And of course, as you're well aware today, Jerusalem is now a city of over 1 million people. It's much larger than it was even 5 years ago. It's now larger than the city of Tel Aviv. And these suburbs are built in the order that's recorded here in the text. So you look at the 9 suburbs that are described here. they were built in exactly the chronological order you see here in the text. Now, what's especially interesting is that the last three suburbs are the locations that are the best places in terms of geography for building suburbs. That they were built last, they weren't built first. In fact, what was interesting is literally the worst geographical location to put a suburb was suburb number one. Now, in the context of modern history, we understand why the suburbs that were built outside of Jerusalem were built in an opposite order that you'd expect from a rational perspective. They were built for defense. And so, yes, the first suburb is a terrible geographical place to put a suburb, but it was the most easily defended against Arab attack. So it was built first. And suburbs 7, 8, and 9, previous to 1967, were under the control of the nation of Jordan. It wasn't until after the 67 war we get the last three suburbs built, because that's when the Israelis finally got control of that area and began. So the really big suburbs of Jerusalem are in what was previously Jordanian territory. So from a modern perspective, we can understand why this apparently backwards order of building the suburbs was built the way it was. Okay. The most remarkable stuff is what you see in the book of Ezekiel. I got 15 minutes left, so let's see if we can get through a lot of this material. Ezekiel 36. Actually, you can start in Ezekiel 32 and read to Ezekiel 40. It's all about the modern nation of Israel. But I'm just going to pick a few texts here. And this is particularly significant for those of you who are aware of what happened in 1948 and what happened in 1967. Son of man, prophesy to the mountains of Israel and say, O mountains of Israel, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says. The enemy said of you, Aha, the ancient heights have become our possession. Therefore prophesy and say, This is what the sovereign Lord says. Because they ravaged and hounded you from every side, so that you became the possession of the rest of the nations and the object of people's malicious talk and slander. Therefore, O mountains of Israel, hear the word of the sovereign Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says to the mountains and hills, to the ravines and valleys, to the desolate ruins and deserted towns that have been plundered and ridiculed by the rest of the nations around you. This is what the sovereign Lord says. In my burning zeal I have spoken against the rest of the nations, and against all Edom, for with glee and with malice in their hearts, they made my land their own possession, so that they might plunder its pasture land. Therefore prophesy concerning the land of Israel, and say to the mountains and hills, to the ravines and the valleys, This is what the sovereign Lord says, I speak of my jealous wrath, because you have suffered the scorn of the nations. Therefore this is what the Lord says, I will swear with uplifted hand that the nations around you will also suffer scorn. Verse 8, But you, O mountains of Israel, will produce branches and fruit for my people Israel, for they will soon come home. I am concerned for you and look on you with favor. You will be plowed and sown, and I will multiply the number of people upon you, even the whole house of Israel. The towns will be inhabited, the ruins rebuilt. I will increase the number of men and animals upon you, and they will be fruitful and become numerous. I will settle people on you as in the past and make you prosper more than before. Then you'll know that I am the Lord. I will cause people, my people Israel, to walk upon you. They will possess you. You'll be their inheritance. You'll never again deprive them of their children. This is what the sovereign Lord says. Because people say to you, you devour people, devour men, and deprive your nation of its children. Therefore, you'll no longer devour men and make your nation childless, declares the sovereign Lord. No longer will I make you hear the taunts of the nations. No longer will you suffer the scorn of the peoples or cause your nation to fall because of the sovereign Lord. Now, again, a little bit about this context here. It keeps referring to the mountains and hills of Israel. If you read the entire book of Ezekiel, it's referring to the ancient high places of worship. And it was particularly the Samaritans, when they settled in the land of Israel, said, well, The Jews in Judah don't like us. They're not going to let us use their high place, namely Mount Moriah. So what they did is they began to establish places of worship all over the land of Israel. And again, I should produce a map here for you. During the time of this first return of Jews to the land of Israel, there were 19 places of worship. These were all on top of high hills and mountains. The chief, of course, being Mount Moriah and the city of Jerusalem, but there were 18 other high hills. In the War of Independence, it was a nation of Jordan. They had the best army of all. Their army was trained by the British and equipped by the British. And so they had this well-equipped, well-trained army, actually led by people who had been trained in the British military. They were the ones that came in the War of Independence and literally took possession of all 19 of those high places of ancient worship. If you actually look at a 1948 map, all the hills and mountains that were the places of worship during the second return of the Jews to Israel as a nation were under the possession of Jordan. And the Jews were basically consigned to the valleys below these hills. And this is making the prediction, okay, a time will come when you will gain control of those hills. The War of 1967, that's when the Israeli army gave priority to capturing all those hills. And they did. By the end of the 67 war, they were in possession of all those hills and mountains. And incidentally, when they took possession of those hills and mountains in 1967, the hills and mountains were barren. Nothing was growing on them. Today, they're rich forests. And so it's become a forested area. Fruit trees, conifers grow over all those areas. But when they took conquest of it in 67, they were barren. And again, this text in Ezekiel 36 says, they will produce. They'll produce fruit for you. They'll produce wealth for you, as they did in the days of old. But that didn't happen until Jews got control of those ancient high places of worship. Now, I became a Christian just before the 67 war, and looking at this text saying, something is going to happen whereby the Jews are going to get control of these ancient high places of worship. And it was a shock to me that in the 67 war, all that happened. In fact, I can tell you a story. I was a graduate student an undergraduate student at the University of British Columbia, but I was doing work with a lot of the graduate students in the physics department. When the 67 war broke out, three of the Egyptian graduate students left to go back to fight in the war, and three Israelis went back to fight in the war. I thought, this is going to be interesting, because these three Egyptians and three Israelis who were in the graduate physics department there, graduate students, they were really good friends. But all six of them left to fight in the 67 war. All six survived. And they came back and they were best friends again. And what they were telling me was they were praying they would not have to meet one another in battle. And they didn't. But to me, that's remarkable. I mean, how they just went like that and just came back. I remember, isn't it interesting? They got possession of all the ancient high places of worship, just like it's predicted here in the book of Ezekiel. But I think the text that had the greatest impact on me was what I saw. Well, here, let me read a little bit more here. This is Ezekiel 36:24. I will take you out of the nations. I'll gather you from all the countries and bring you back into your own land. So here again, it's referring how Jews from all over the world will come back to the land of Israel. First, when the areas around the Middle East, and then from nations from around the world. But I think the thing that the biggest impact on me before I was a believer was reading the first part of Ezekiel 37. The hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me out by the Spirit of the Lord and set me in the middle of a valley. It was full of bones. He led me back and forth among them, and I saw a great many bones on the floor of the valley, bones that were very dry. And he asked me, Son of man, can these bones live? I said, Sovereign Lord, you alone know. Then he said to me, prophesy to these bones and say to them, dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the Sovereign Lord says to these bones. I'll make them breathe, enter you, and you will come to life. I will attach tendons to you and make flesh come upon you and cover you with skin. I'll put breath in you. You'll come to life. Then you'll know that I am the Lord. So I prophesied as I was commanded. And as I was prophesying, there was a noise, a rattling sound. The bones came together, bone to bone. I looked, and tendons and flesh appeared to them. Skin covered them, but there was no breath in them. Then he said to me, prophesy to the breath. Prophesy, son of man, and say to it, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe into these slain that they may live. So I prophesied, and as he commanded me, and breath entered them, they came to life and stood up on their feet, a vast army. Then he said to me, son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. They say our bones are dried up, our hope is gone, we are cut off. Therefore prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. O my people, I'm going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I'll bring you back to the land of Israel. Then you, my people, will know that I am the Lord when I open your graves and bring you up from them. I will set my spirit in you, and you will live. I will settle you in your own land. Then you'll know that I, the Lord, have spoken, and I have done it, declares the Lord. Now, this is the same Ezekiel prophesying that when God brings the Jews back into the land, the nation is formed from a second time, they will not give God the credit, but the Gentiles will. If you read everything Ezekiel says about the second rebirth, he says, a time will come when they'll actually give credit to me, credit to God for what he's done for them in the land. Initially, no, but it will come. Now, this had a big impact on me before I was a believer, because this is a time when I was studying what happened in the Holocaust and thereafter. And I had actually looked at a newspaper photograph showing this enormous valley filled with more than 100,000 Jewish skeletons, then reading the beginning of Ezekiel 37 and saying, this is that valley filled with all these bones. And notice how it uses the analogy here. It talks about individuals who have died, their bones are there, they're dead, and then they come back to life. But notice it gives us very careful explanation of what's happening in this word picture. Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. So it's not literally talking about how God's going to raise to life all these dead Jews from the graves of the Holocaust. But he says, I'm going to raise up the nation. And when all the peoples, Gentile peoples, look out and say, having seen the extent of the Holocaust, they're going to say, it's done. It's not going to happen. But he says, that's when I'll breathe life and the nation will be born. So we're coming to that period. Yes.
I need to interrupt you early.
Yes.
It's Christmas.
Right.
That means cards for Hugh Ross.
Well, thank you. Now, I really enjoy reading all the, I mean, you guys are very generous in what you say.
Well, you're more generous with us. Thank you.
So thank you.
Every Christmas, we want to be able to say thank you to you for all your love and the heart that you put into each one of us in this class, and this is a small thing that we can do. It took three cards for everybody to write everything, and there's some other little cash in there for you, too. So.
Well, thank you. I mean, you do this every year. I don't expect it. But thank you for your generosity, and especially thank you for your generous comments. You know, my wife and I read these, and it motivates us to persevere.
Oh, good.
So, I mean, I just got a blistering attack on my Facebook page today, so I think this is going to help me recover.
Just take a picture of it and send it.
There we go. So, thank
you. Excuse me. Well, everybody, let's say thank you to Dr. Hugh Ross for everything he does.
Thank you.
All year.
Very good. All right. Well, we'll wrap this up next week, but let me close in prayer. But again, I encourage you, take these passages I've given to you. You know, just for me, it was a super blessing reading all these verses that I got here in a single page in one sitting. It literally blows you away. And I think what I get from a lot of skeptics, they just say, well, you know what? That's your interpretation of that text, but they're only looking at one text. When you pull them all together, it's just like the prophecies of the life of Jesus in his first coming. If you just look at one prophecy, you say, well, maybe that's misinterpreted. When you put the whole lot together, there really is no doubt this was predicting all the details of the life of Jesus. Likewise, what I'm sharing with you, when you actually look at all of these texts, and again, in one sitting, you get an overwhelming sense. These are all the details of what's happened in the nation of Israel. And again, if you read on, even specific details of the wars that be fought between Israel and her Arab enemies, they're recorded in detail here. It's just incredible. And so, but again, it's the Gentiles that are noticing. But a day will come when the Jews themselves will recognize this is the hand of God. With that, let me pray. Father in heaven, we see your hand all over. We see it in the record of nature. We see it in Scripture. Father, at this particular Christmas season, I pray that you'd make us more aware than ever before just how much your hand is upon us, upon the nations of the world. Lord, I pray that as we begin to be in a doubt and turmoil at the mess that the world is in right now, that we'd appreciate this is all under your control. And not just the nations, you're under control of individual lives. So Father, I pray you'd make each of us sensitive as to the specific path that you want each of us to take. Thank you that you put us here on the earth for a very specific purpose. Help us to discern that and fulfill that with all of the strength that we have within us and with all the joy that you make it all the glory. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.